Today's show is brought to you by Bogart Extractors, an industry leader in hydrocarbon extraction. Over the last decade, Bogart has implemented many new technologies which have helped to revolutionize the way hydrocarbon extractions are performed. Each unit is made with sanitary stainless steel and is built and tested right here in the USA. Their certified system for use in licensed facility meet all NFPA and ASME standards and undergo peer reviewed by third-party engineers to ensure facilities and its employees can operate safely. Beyond simply making a functional extractor, Bogart has many additional features which make extraction faster and more cost-effective compared to other manufacturers. These features include hydrocarbon failing films to supercharge evaporation rates, heavy-duty explosion-proof pumps for flammable liquids and vapors, industrial chillers capable of maintaining large tanks of solvent at temperatures below 60 Celsius. They also offer extensive tech support and consultation services. So whether you need to set up an extraction lab from scratch or you just need some replacement gaskets, give them a call at 855-553-3887 or check out their website at www.bogart.com.
Excellent. So we are recording. We have myself, Mark Rastelli. We've got Franco Smit in Cape Town, South Africa. And then we have Emily Gogol with Infinite Tree. Say hello, everybody.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey. Thanks for being here again. We're on our long format conversation here because obviously with the hemp show, we've only got 15 minutes and it's really hard to pack in some quality information in that 15 minutes because it flies by. I know there's a lot of stuff that we didn't go over, we didn't touch on, but if you don't mind, I'd love you to dive into your background and just kind of introduce yourself in your own words so I don't butcher them.
Oh, I'm sure you would do fine.
Hey, yeah. I butcher everything. Just give me a chance and I will destroy it.
Well, yeah. So I guess it's a little complicated what we do here at Infinite Tree and kind of my role and what I'm involved in. So basically we started Infinite Tree to really provide best in class hemp cultivars for the craft flower market. What we do at Infinite Tree, we are a soup to nuts production nursery. So we do everything from create the plants, the breeding, the new material, and test that material, make sure it is ready to be released publicly, to creating the commercial seed, bringing those plants to market, and then working with other partners in the industry that have similar testing, rigorous values around creating craft hemp flower. So, you know, how I got into this in terms of the work is, you know, I feel like there's just so many questions that you need to ask your breeder about the material that you're putting in the ground. And when we looked at the industry, we thought, gosh, there is a huge need for reliable material, whether it's on the biomass side or the craft flower side, even though we're primarily on the craft flower side. So as we developed Infinite Tree, we really focused on bringing in genetic lines that are going to work for the farmers to create products they can sell. So we don't release a variety unless we know it's going to have real market value. Either it's been proven in the market years past by a craft flower breeder that they've just grown exclusively, and then we work with that breeder to turn it into a nursery product for farmers across the country. So we really are focused on that kind of reliability and proven success, not only in the field, but also in the marketplace. And that has a lot to do with, my background, I think, coming from science, being a scientist for many years.
Well, I got a ton of questions about that. Okay. So we're definitely going to get to the background as a scientist, because that's very intriguing. However, I just want to touch on what you mentioned with genetics. Obviously, I mean, it rings true. Basically, if you have bad genetics and you're putting bad seeds in the ground, you can only do so much. Doesn't matter if you are the best cultivator in the world.
It's going to make your life hard. Just making your life harder. Yeah. It's like, there's a lot of folks who, I've talked to farmers like, well, I started off the season thinking I was going to create biomass. And then it turned out I needed to create flower products for my buyer. And it's just a huge nightmare.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I mean, you're basically just shooting yourself in the foot, right? Spend 3-4 months growing your product, processing it to find out that the genetics were terrible, and you're basically stuck with inferior crop.
Yeah. So we work really hard to make sure that all of the folks that we work with are very educated as to what they're growing, you know. And I'm agnostic in a sense about what to put in your field. You know, we have our own product line, but I recommend other product lines as well. We want farmers to be successful. And if they want to grow 10 different things, I want them to be successful growing our product line and then also the additional product lines that they bring in. So we talk to the farmers we work with a lot about why they're making these choices, how they're going to process, and what their end market is. So we really try to provide as much information as we can to make them successful, to help ensure they're successful, really.
I definitely encounter a lot of farmers that do not do that. They just jumped right into the space. And, you know, good for them for doing that. However, it's like flipping a coin, right?
It's hard.
Yeah. And especially with such a new industry, there's so many bad genetics out there. And, you know, people are trying to search for the best prices on seeds or clones. And it's like, hey, $10 or 10 cents a seed, you know, it's a deal, right? But a deal for what? What are you getting?
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of the time that I talk at like shows and stuff about people is it's really hard because there's a lot of seed companies offering really cheap seed right now. And the question is, this is not like buying in bulk at Costco, you know, and it's discounted. Like it's still really high quality vodka, but it's Kirkland vodka. You know what I mean?
Like right. Kirkland's like, is basically Grey Goose in a different bottle.
Yeah.
Right?
It's you're not getting Grey Goose in a different bottle for 10. What you're getting is most likely a product from a breeder who created too much inventory that they're looking to move. And if they don't have a lot of great information, if you're not like wowed by their data package, and they should have a data package, not just a photo of a COA and a cola and tell you it grows great for craft flour in New Jersey, you know, like that's not enough. You know, it's very buyer beware. So I think people are very attracted by the low prices because they think I want to save money. But what they're really doing is limiting their market potential, because even on the craft flour market, you know, we know that if you're growing something that everybody else is growing, doesn't have great, just has okay structure, just has okay terpenes, you're not getting very much for your craft flower product. And we know outdoor growers who are growing rare, unique, highly dense big nugs with 3-4% terpenes, and they're getting between $400 and $700 a pound wholesale. Wow. So that's like double to triple what other folks are getting. And it has to do with what they're bringing to market. It's not just their salespeople are geniuses. I mean, they have great salespeople, but you have to have a quality product. So what, you save 50 cents a plant in May, you know, like, so what, you save $5,000.
Right. What'd you lose in October?
Yeah. And then, but $5,000, I mean, that's nothing on the flower end if you're able to sell your flower for double or triple a pound. And I'm not even talking about yield. Like, we're not even going into like the differences in yield on this stuff, right? Because we all know small, airy buds, they do not weigh. So you have to grow so much more to get the pounds that you would from a real dense, heavy resin craft flower variety. So it's really hard, because everyone wants to save money and they think I can save on my seeds, I can save on my plants, I can save on my clones, and they are shooting themselves in the foot for later in the year. You get what you pay for.
Right. Right. Well, it's, yeah. Wow. That, it's very interesting because as so many farmers we encounter did exactly that. They went for cheap genetics and they have inferior crop when it comes to harvest time.
And the other thing about the cheap genetics too, like I said, The reason they're so inexpensive typically is because it's a new company and they just want to move units. You know, they made 10 million units of whatever, and they need to move 10 million units, and they don't care how they move it. They just need it out of their warehouse.
Right. And something like seeds, you know, when you're in that commodities market / for seeds, and you're just looking at seed as a commodity, not as, you know, a boutique genetic strain that's going to help your market potential. It's kind of treated just like distillate, where it's a race to the bottom.
Exactly.
What's the cheapest price I can find my seeds for? What's the cheapest? Right. Hey, I need 1,000 kilos of distillate. Yeah, you know, exactly. What's the cheapest price I can get it for? But it's not the same.
But distillate is not seed. You know, distillate is a very defined product that you can then use for value, you know, to do other things with. With the seed, you know, it stacks against you. That seed may not germinate well. Even if the germination report says 92%, you know, it may not actually be 92%. Feminization report might look good. How many hermaphrodites do they record per acre? When you ask your breeder, well, what's your hermaphrodite rate per acre? They should know that answer, you know? Right. So like hermaphrodites, that's huge labor cost. Dead plants, plants that aren't vigorous and die, dampening off as an issue from the seed because it wasn't created properly. Lodging in the field due to wind, you might lose 10% to a high wind event if they're plants that lodge. And then let's get to yield. Maybe they don't yield very well. They have larfy open bud structure. So it maybe could be considered a craft flower, but you're not going to get the pound, you know, the weight off of each plant that you would get with a really dense craft flower. I would consider a craft flower variety. So it's not that you just, it's not like buying cheap distillate where, okay, distillate the thing. It's like every time you go along the grow cycle from seed to final product, you're getting hit with extra labor costs, extra processing costs, losses in the field, you know, losing 10% of your field to pests or wind because they're not very good plants. And then the flower, you're going to have a hard time moving because if they were selling that seed at 10 cents a seed and everybody and their brother has it, if everybody and their brother has it as a flower product, you're probably not going to get top dollar for it.
Right.
If it's common, you know, so people are, it's surprise. It's, I think, why we see tissue culture and clone.
I literally just wrote that down because I'm writing down a ton of questions as you did that. And then one of the ones coming up was tissue culture and you just so happened to get to it before I mentioned it.
Yeah. And I think I'm saying that's why they can charge so much because people say, look, I'll pay $5 a plant because, well, there are many reasons people like the idea of tissue culture and we can go into my thoughts on tissue culture if you want, but I'm just saying it's like, it's split the market. There's people who want really cheap seed. And then I kind of took out another section like, oh, wait a minute, cheap seed is bunk. I know that. I'm going to go for the most expensive thing on the market because expensive means quality. It's like the thing, like if it's expensive, it'll work better for me. And so I think that's why there's such this huge window. You've got people paying 10 cents a seed, and then you have people paying $5 a tissue culture clone. You know, you might get the same quality flower out the other end, depend, you know, so it's
really expensive. Cheap. Expensive has a different expectation of value out the back end. But I mean, there's got to be some type of fine median in the middle where it really comes down to, you know, cost versus value, right? Yeah. I mean, So one of the questions here is I want to dive into this process with you. So if I'm a client and I engage with you and I have a farm, we'll just say it's 10 acres. Okay. And
great size for craft flower, Mark. I love it.
Yeah. So 10 acres for craft flower. Woo. That'd be quite a bit. But, so what does this process look like for you? I mean, as far as, are you asking me what I'm attempting to sell, what my products are attempting to be?
Always start with the product. I'm going to ask you, is this your first, you know, tell me about your farm. And when you tell me about your farm, I want to make sure I learn who you work with on the sales side. Let's just
role play this. So okay. I got 10 acres. I grew in my garage for 5 years and someone just gave me a bunch of money because I'm ready to dive into the hemp industry. I've got Franco here. Franco's offering me seeds for 5 cents a seed. Says he's got the most killer strains ever.
They're really dank, right, Mark? They're dank.
Ultra dank, perfect for Southern California growing, you know, but.
Oh, you're in Southern California. That's nice. Yeah.
But a friend told me that Franco was a con artist and that I should be talking to Emily with Infinite Tree because you know what you're doing. So that's why we're here.
Well, thank you so much. I will have to thank your friend. I'll give your friend a call and thank them personally. I'm so glad they recommended us. I'll have to give them a call. And I love hearing you're growing in Southern California. You're doing 10 acres and your experience is in indoor growing. So that's really good to know. That really helps me help you be successful now that you've transitioned to outdoor hemp flower. So the first thing is, it sounds like you want to be in the craft flower market. and you're really used to growing high terpene, resiny, beautiful, big, crystally buds from the indoor world. And I want to let you know, I want to let you know right now, Mark, that hemp is really moving in that direction to getting that indoor quality, like, you know, from the marijuana industry bud outdoors. So we're finally getting there. We're not as far ahead as the marijuana industry, but we're getting there. So you can absolutely grow outdoor hemp and get the beautiful bud structure that's dense and resinous and fully trichromed cakey crystals with hemp, but it's not going to be as good as marijuana. So I want to set your expectation there.
Okay.
And the things you need to look out for, the questions you should be asking the other gentleman you mentioned who has very inexpensive seed, you should ask him for outdoor growing, because now you're doing 10 acres. So you're growing thousands of plants. What's the hermaphrodite rate? Do you have samples of the flower? Can you share a sample with me of what you consider your like finished product? Who grew it last year? How many acres? Is this a brand new variety? Did you just grow it on your farm, or did you have other farmers who grew it? And what was their experience? Those are really basic questions aside from a COA and a germ report that you need to know. So now that you're growing an acreage, germination is important if you're buying seeds, because if you want 10,000 plants and you have to grow an extra 3,000 plants to make sure you make your numbers, that labor and everything really adds up. So that's why a lot of folks that my company works with, Infinite Tree, they prefer to buy plants direct from us. We deliver direct at the peak of perfection. So whether you're doing 10 acres or 50 acres, we work with your farm to make sure the plants arrive at the right time for your field crew to get them into the ground. Because I'm sure, Mark, as you know from indoor growing, it's very important that the plants have a continuous growth cycle, right? You don't want them to have a lack of vigor and have to be stalled, right? Whether you're growing indoors or on 10 acres, they're still plants. Sure. So it's really important that those plants get to you at the right time. And that when you have to remember that when you purchase plants, you're getting like a plant that's ready to go. When you purchase seeds, you're getting a hope. You're hoping that will become a plant you can put in the ground. So you have to account for.
And you're primarily a plant provider, not a seed.
We are primarily a plant provider. Yes.
Okay.
So when you work with us, we provide you with plants. But if you're going to grow this other gentleman's varieties as well, along with our varieties, we're happy to do contract germination so that you get all of your plants in the same format at the same age, peak of perfection, grown by us as professionals. And we're happy to work with you. We absolutely do that for clients. So we're agnostic. If you want to grow a couple other breeders' varieties with our varieties, I think that's great. And I can recommend a whole product line to you so that you can have a more comprehensive grow that meets your needs. And we're happy to start all those plants together so you get the right format and they're at the peak of perfection for your field. Because we've seen huge differences in performance from different kinds of plants.
Now, what did the turnaround time look like? And in association with that, so I just want to talk about on just the plants, because I have another question related to that for things like custom genetics or coming, you know,
we breeding. Do that as well.
Now, when it comes to just the plants, I would be ordering from a catalog, right? A catalog of genetics. And then when you are, I'm assuming you're cloning the plants, or are you germinating from seed yourself?
We specialize in our populations are very stable, and we work with feminized seed for this reason. So we have really great, it's called homogeneity out in the field. So every plant looks like its neighbor.
Okay. So, but when we're talking about the plant I'm receiving, is that coming from it's coming from the feminized seeds that you guys germinated yourselves and then
correct. Yep.
Wrapped up. Okay. So it's not coming from, you know, say a mother colony where you're just taking a bunch of cuttings. Okay. Excellent. Now, does that, I'm assuming that would obviously help for things like genetic drift, because you're not taking the same genetics from a mother time and time again.
Yeah. I think the question you're asking there is like, what's our expectation for a population, right?
Right.
And when you grow a clonal population, whether it's from a clone or it's tissue culture, by definition, it should be very homogeneous. And you should have expectations around plant height, plant width, cannabinoid profile, and terpene profile. And they should be able to speak to that. Like if you measured up 10 plants, what's the variation look like? So you can achieve more quickly with a cutting or a tissue culture plant homogeneity in your population. It takes more work to get that level of close to that level of homogeneity in a seed population. We're very fortunate that we have some amazing lines that we've developed, and they're very homogeneous across the population. So the main thing is to ask yourself when you're working with a seed provider versus a clone or tissue culture provider, like, what's your end goal? Do you want to make sure everything is harvested at the exact same time? And even though it's a clonal population, there may still be variation in harvest, and same with the seed population. So those are questions you should ask your breeder. We work with seed populations where I can say, I know for a fact, there's about 10% of the population in our Oregon guava that matures about 3 days earlier. And for most folks on harvest, that's like no big deal. They want to start harvest. You know, harvest happens over a window for craft flower typically, and that's no big deal. But we've trialed other breeders' material. We trial like dozens of things every year from other folks that we're looking to work with. And, you know, the variation can be 50%. You know, it can be half the field is different. And that's unacceptable. So I think if you're really concerned about harvest window, for example, you need to ask your seed provider questions like, does some of it mature? And you need to ask the exact same question of a clone or tissue culture provider. And they should have the answers. When it comes to cannabinoid variation, again, clonal plants, tissue culture are going to be more similar, but you can still achieve the same results in a seed population if you've done the breeding work. The issue is most seed providers have not done the breeding work to get homogeneous expression out in the field. And it's hard. It's very hard.
The O-Cannabis Conference and Expo returns to Toronto June 1st through the 3rd, and there are still good booth locations available. This exciting event is free for cannabis retailers and will feature Tommy Chung receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award at the O-Cannabis Industry Awards. For more information about exhibiting or to register to attend, go to ocannabis.com. That's OCANNABIZ.com.
Yeah. Now question for, this is a question I'm curious about. Would your crop be hardier and more resistant to, let's say, a freeze or a pest infestation or a mold infestation or a disease, having that slight genetic variation as opposed to being completely, you know, the exact same genetics across everything because it came from a clone?
Yeah. So I think, I do have a bit of background in evolutionary biology, so I can speak to this at a population level.
You are a scientist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a scientist. I'm not a physicist, though. Right? I'm a biologist who studied genetics.
Right.
So I know a little bit about this, but I'm also going to say, in terms of a buyer's perspective, Mark, like, if you have a mixed population in your field, okay, let's take a step back. Your field could look identical. The flower structure, the smells, the cannabinoid profile, identical, okay, on paper. But when a mold spore, you know, wipes through your crop, you know, you get like some crazy fungal thing happening in the fall, that fungus doesn't see the bud structure, doesn't see the cannabinoid profile, doesn't see the heights. It sees the immune system of that plant. And because it's a seed population, it's going to have more variation than a clonal population, period. Mm-hmm. So you could have a seed population that to you as a human and by the numbers in the lab looks identical. But when that fungus wipes through your field, it's going to see different populations out there because the immune system of each plant is a little different. It's from seed. Okay. So my answer is yes, a seed population is generally much better at pests and disease resistant, potentially frost, not so much, but more pests and disease than a clonal population. With a clonal population, you're more likely to get entirely wiped out. So there is a strong argument, especially for people growing in humid areas, to not plant clones, to plant from seed. I talked to a lot of farmers in the East and the Southeast, and usually farmers who grow other crops as well. And they understand the benefit of a seed population and that you can still have, by human standards, a totally uniform looking field, like the flower, the smell, the cannabinoids, totally uniform. But when that fungus sees that field, it's seeing all these different immunotypes, and it doesn't, it might take out 10% of the population, but it won't take out 100%. You know what I'm saying? So
right. It's kind of working its way through the field. It's like, I destroyed these 10 plants, but those ones are, they're giving
me too difficult
here and I can't quite get into them.
Right. Exactly. But it's a hard thing in our industry because a lot of seed on the market is brand new and it's not been bred well enough to be homogeneous in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard.
So as we're on the homogeneous conversation here, let's talk about tissue culturing. Yep. Now, just, I'm going to give you my understanding real fast. So I have genetics. I want my genetics to be preserved, or I'd like to have them be ultimately duplicated. And so I would then give my genetics to a lab who then basically cleans up the genetics. And the way I understood it, it takes about 6 months to do, to basically preserve that exact genetic line so that I can then recall those genetics via tissue culture, where they basically do a little tissue culture in the lab to recreate all my different plants. And then I would have the exact same genetics across, my entire field. And potentially I could recall those genetics years later. So if I had a line in 1996 that I was just so jazzed about, that eventually after 24 years drifted and is ultimately not the same plant that it was 24 years prior, I could say, hey, I'd like to recall those genetics and let's get that tissue culture back up and then plant it in my field and go from there.
Yeah. And I think honestly, Mark, you're that's spot on. That's a great walkthrough from the beginning of how you get started tissue culture to like the goals of tissue culture. The one thing I would say is that, it's just hard to keep something around for many years in terms of library space, production value, things get, things happen on farms. So I think there's a lot of value. The genetic drift, I'm not as worried about in terms of what that means for cannabis. I think it's more like making sure it's preserved. Like if someone accidentally kills the two copies that we have, we still have it. You know what I mean? Like you don't have to maintain two copies to make sure like growing all the time year round. You have it in a freezer. And if you know in advance, they can bring it out of the freezer, grow it, and then it can become production. So I think I'm not too worried about drift. I'm more worried about like accidents.
Like catastrophic failures.
Like the power goes out for 3 weeks.
What's going on right now in the
farm is
in most of the country.
Or your farm burns down. Like we saw in Oregon, a lot of folks lost their farms, this year in Oregon and California. So
right, along with most of their genetics, unless they had some sort of seed bank or tissue culture or something along those lines.
Yeah. So seed banks are good. They're a lot cheaper and more mobile. And you're in control of your seed bank, as opposed to tissue culture, you're not, it's like in a lab, someone you're paying a service provider for that. So that's totally tissue culture. I think the thing to look out for tissue culture is people make a lot of claims about like cleaning your genetics. I mean, they'll screen it for like viruses and other pathogens. And through the tissue culture process, if your line does have like a virus, it is possible to create virus-free stock from that. But like, first you have to have the virus, then they have to make sure they get rid of it. Is this important to you? But I think the tangible selling point on tissue culture is that you're getting something that's totally homogeneous because it's a clone, basically. And it's preservation. I think having your stuff cryo-preserved somewhere, if you need it years later, is great for you. You have to ask yourself questions though, like who's really paying for that? Like how many people are signing up for the service? And the other one is like, well, in 10 years, do you really want to still have that variety? Like, is that going to be relevant in the marketplace?
Yeah. Like, I mean, are we still smoking weed from the 70s that was like, 5% THC,
Yeah. Who knows what hemp and marijuana are going to be in 10 years? So I think people are attracted to it. It's kind of like shiny and sciencey and people like it. Tissue culture for me is not a nursery production thing. It's a research thing. I look at tissue culture as the format for doing research. So if you want to introduce a new trait
Like, you want your hemp to smell like strawberries, which is what I want. Okay. Yeah. So you want your hemp to smell like strawberries. How would you do that? Well, you could take the cassette of genes that create the strawberry terpene profile, build that cassette in a lab, and through tissue culture, because of the methods we have available in tissue culture that aren't available like for during seed production, we can literally insert those genes that make strawberry aromas happen into the tissue culture plant and then grow up the plants that have those genes. And you can do that in the lab using tissue culture much better than trying to do it through natural breeding, you know, traditional breeding projects. A lot longer, a lot harder, a lot more numbers, like big numbers. You got to grow tens of thousands of plants to find them, you know.
Right. Where
tissue culture as a method allows you to do that research, to bring in new genes, to make hemp different. So
potentially if I'm just putting them side by side and we have a genetic seed bank, you know, that's taking into account the traits of the plant versus a tissue culture bank. And I wanted to produce that strawberry flavored, you know, hemp flower, then it would be easier to do it with the tissue culture bank versus the genetic seed bank. Because with that one, I'm having to, germinate all the seeds, grow them to become the flower, and then ultimately cross pollinate them in different variations and then evaluate that afterwards.
I could
do that vastly faster with just grabbing all those tissue gene, those cultures and the genes in there. And then just, I don't even know how I'm imagining this is like a
cut and paste. It's like cut and paste, Mark. Think of it that way. You're cutting.
I'm
elaborate, expensive cut and paste.
I'm picturing a syringe with a bunch of green juice and you're just like,
sure. Not
probably completely wrong, but
it's okay though. It's fine. You don't have to be, it actually uses, typically you can use a bacterium that inserts the genes, or you can even use gold particles. You coat DNA on gold particles,
shoot
those into the cells.
So with the bacteria, would that be like a CRISPR style situation?
Yeah, you can use, you can be CRISPR mediated. Yeah, you know what CRISPR is. Yeah, so you can, CRISPR is
a little bit. I'm kind of being a little bit facetious about the squirting of the green juice.
I guess I'm saying is the point is other people in the plant world do this with other plants all the time.
It's happening in other industries.
Oh yeah. We have GMO, you know what I mean? You know about GMO.
Soybeans. Everybody knows GMO soybeans.
Yeah. So there are ways. So I think what I'm saying is people are using tissue culture right now as like a fancier version of cloning for scale. It's very expensive, you know? So I think that's why it costs so much for tissue culture. I think prices are artificially low right now because I think investors like want to see traction. So they'd rather get the clients now while they have all this cash on hand, get you as a client. And then next year, you know,
you want your genetics again, triple the price.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully not that, but I'm just saying, I have a feeling it just costs a lot of money. There's a reason why seed for tomatoes is cheap. You know what I'm saying? Like seed is inexpensive to produce. Tissue culture is not. So in my mind, if you can create a quality homogeneous product that delivers in the marketplace using seed, you're golden. It's nature's way of propagation. It is how nature wants to make it happen. It's always going to be the most cost-effective, like, period. Right.
I was going to say nature already does it so well. I mean, as long as we can help to guide nature to do it better, I mean, that would be the most efficient, effective way.
Exactly. So for me, you know, you just have to think when you do tissue culture or cloning, it's like, what are you paying for? You know, get a sample of the smokable flower. You know, it's not magic, you know, it's still a plant, you know? So it's like, just because it went through tissue culture doesn't mean it's going to have great bud structure and amazing terpenes and has a data package behind it talking about how it grows in the field. It still can lodge. It can still get overtaken by fungus. It can still have, you know, issues with terpene content or bud structure. So I think it still has the same high bar that it should meet, even though it's a tissue culture plant. So I think that's part of it. But Yeah, I think on the research side, I think of tissue culture as for research. I don't think of it as for scaling nursery, although quite a few people are doing tissue culture. So we'll see how it works out for them. They're well, fine.
When I first heard of tissue culture, I was like, wow, this is definitely going to be the future of the space. Yet I'm still kind of yet to see it become ubiquitous across, you know, multiple different farms or large farms. It's really kind of few and far between. I mean, I don't talk to farms that actually do it consistently.
Yeah. Well, farms don't do it. Labs do it.
No, that's what I meant. I meant the farms using
okay.
plants. Yeah. Yeah.
Last year we had a couple vendors on the market for tissue culture. I think
in the cannabis space, I mean, I've been talking
to companies
that tissue culture for the past like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. In hemp.
Okay.
Yeah,
I just assumed if they're doing it in the cannabis, I mean, it's the same species of plant, right? Just with variations.
Yes. So I know, some people don't realize that. And I'm like, it's the exact same plant, everybody.
That's actually a trick question that I ask people all the time. And I ask them it just to get kind of a baseline of their understanding of, you know, cannabis versus.
You're so cannabis. Mean, Mark.
And it's, question. But it's such, it's, I mean, it is kind of mean because it's totally a trick question. It's like, so, yeah. And I just ask them, you know, what's the difference between a cannabis plant and a hemp plant? You know, in the species. And they're like, oh, it's this. I'm like, no, it's actually exactly the same, right? But just the genetic variations on how much CBD versus THC they produce.
Legal, it's a legal definition. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I got another interesting one here that I want to run by you about. Okay. So I actually have a background in the wine industry. I got a minor in viticulture and I have a degree in ag business. I've worked for vineyards. I've pruned plants. I didn't know
all this, Mark. That's amazing. Yeah,
this is all, I've got like eight different like kind of life experiences that are completely different. I don't know if you know, I was a professional football player as well. Huh. So that's what I mean. I've done all these like random things that don't kind of match up, but you're like, yeah, it's like a different lifetime ago. But one of the things that is across all of the viticulture wine industry is rootstocks, because yep. out here in the US, the soil and the diseases, basically they will destroy plants that do not have a US native rootstock. So, you know, when you have things like Cabernet, Sauvignon, Zinfandel coming over from Europe, they will get destroyed. They just won't make it out here. So you have to have a rootstock. And I came across a business last year out of Israel that claimed to have created a rootstock that would increase your yields by, it was something astronomical. It's like increase them by 200% with this. You know, there was a lot of claims in that, but I do get the power of a rootstock. You know, so if you have a rootstock that's basically just shooting nutrients up into the plant, you could potentially have much, you know, healthier, bigger, smellier buds than ones struggling.
Yeah.
So they were grafting and doing rootstocks, and they were selling their plants as a, you know, their actually proprietary rootstock that they had developed on top of whatever strain or on the bottom of whatever strain that it is that you would like to produce. So I'm curious to ask you about that. Have you encountered anything like that? And
cannabis, I should say.
Yeah.
No. And I've encountered none of this, so I don't know, but I would say there's a lot of talk in the industry about grow this cannabis in this region, grow that cannabis in that region, grow here, grow there. And when I look at the data, there really isn't much information. It's like, oh, well, I have some friends that grew it in Georgia and it did okay. So it's adapted to Georgia or something. And you're like, what does that really mean? So I think people are excited by the idea of like bioregions and like bioregion specific cannabis, but I haven't seen it pan out. There are plenty of very specific growing conditions across the United States. You can be in the quote same bioregion, but have very different conditions on your farm.
Right.
I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying to date, I haven't really seen something that's like a specific, like grow this hemp in this exact soil and weather pattern, you know, like moisture and humidity and stuff. It's all very anecdotal to me. Right. the information is very anecdotal. One day we might have developed very specific cannabis varieties for different areas. I don't think we're there. I never make claims about that. I think overall though, cannabis is a really adaptive plant. There's a reason it's called ditchweed, right? So I think like we need to remember it's a pretty adaptable plant. I think the problem is in our industry, we confuse not very good plants, like breeders who aren't really trialing their material and making good selections on one hand with the bioregion. Like, you know what I mean? Like just because it didn't do well on your farm in South Carolina doesn't mean it's a South Carolina problem. Do you know what I'm saying?
Totally.
It's more likely where I stand right now, a breeder problem with how they selected that plant and the research and the trials and the hard work that goes into really creating a great variety was not done. Because I feel it's a feeling. I'm going to say it's a feeling still, not like hard evidence. It's a feeling because I don't have enough years. We've only been at this, you know, hemp has only been legal for, you know, less than a decade. Right. So,
right. And in 2015, you could not find a good hemp, hemp flower anywhere. It was all trash.
Exactly.
So look at how far it's come.
You know, we loved it. We were like, oh my God, it's available. So what I'm saying is in 10 years, after 10 years, I will say it's not a feeling, but the feeling I have so far is if it's a quality plant, it has good characteristics in terms of agricultural characteristics, just start there. I feel like it can go pretty much anywhere in the US. Like it's, I think it could really do well anywhere. It's really about when it matures. Like you don't want something that matures really late in like a frost area. You know what I mean? Like maturity at the end is important, but it should be a good plant to start with. That's right. The main thing. And then it can go anywhere. This whole bioregion thing. I'm like,
My take on this, I agree with everything you just said. And when there's obviously there's strains that are known to be just super high yields. Then there's strains that are known to be, you know, incredibly low yielding strains. Yep. Yep. To me, it would make sense if you put a rootstock on that's known for just being huge and producing a lot of, you know, really heavy weight on the plant and flower, putting that on the bottom of something that's known to not produce well, to me, it would make sense, but the caveat. And so when you're doing it with wine, those plants are in the ground for hundreds of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So in that case, it is a necessity. And when you spend the extra dollars because of, you know, it has to have a specific rootstock. Doesn't matter. You're spending that one time and then you're going to benefit the next 50 to 100 years, however long that plant's in the ground. But with hemp, you know, it's only in the ground for 3-4 months, you know, depending on where you're growing or how you're growing it. So you have to do it every single time. Right. And when I was talking to this business, I asked them a question because they put up the pricing per clone / and I don't know what the pricing is for you guys. Can you just give me a ballpark real quick on, say, if I'm buying 10,000 plants, what the price of, you know, let's say a 12-inch little seedling would be? Or
we will ship 12-inch seedlings, but not so when you plant acreage, they're typically in like a T72 or higher format. So okay. Give that, but I mean, ballpark in the industry, right, for plants, quality plants right now, depending on the volume, range between $2 and $4.
Okay. So that the reason I wanted you to put that number out there is because that's the number that I'm familiar with. Yeah. And smaller volume, $5.
$2 to $4.
And there goes my wife. She's gonna work out. So when I was talking to this company, they had the quote at $20 per plant. And that was at volume. And I was just like, look, I know that you're getting better yield or at least from your studies, you're getting better yield and it sounds great, but I just don't see people paying 4 times, 10 times, you know, 8 times the price, whatever it is.
You're not going to get 8 times yield.
Right. Like, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They need to work on their math a little bit there. They need to redo their spreadsheets and figure that out.
Well, just think of the amount of labor and just the processes to you know,
on an annual crop.
One plant in 20 acres worth of crop, and each one of those plants needs its own stock and has to be grafted. Mm-mm. I mean, that's kind of it's an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I think we need to focus on breeders developing rigorous field trials. I work every year really hard with our team to have vigorous, like really black and white field trials to determine material selection and to then communicate that information to our farmers. I think that needs to be, we just need to go back to basics. Like none of this fancy rootstock, if tissue culture works for you, great, but it's not a silver bullet, you know. It still has to meet the same criteria as everything else. So I think really getting, drilling down on quality seed production that makes flour that you can sell, that has a proven success in the marketplace. That's
right. I completely agree. And I know we're getting close to we've only got about 4 minutes. We're getting close to your hard stop here. So we can kind of start to transition this. We're going to have to get on again because I still have like 8 questions here written down.
Write them down too.
No, they're written down right in front of me. Okay. That I'm like, we're going to get on this one again because this was really interesting. I mean, I definitely enjoyed this. Now, overall, I just kind of want your final thoughts on where you see the industry when it comes to breeding and genetics and where you see it in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years? Like what does it look like and where is it going to go?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that...
And you only have 3 minutes to answer.
Yeah, first total THC laws. Let's just put the total THC laws aside and let's just say that we will have more opportunities to breed plants with different cannabinoid profiles in the future. So I'm just going to put that aside. With that aside, I think it's really about consumer demand. And to be honest, consumers want taste, flavor, aroma. Cannabinoids are like, do I want this? You know, it's like, I think right now, because it's novel and because of the laws, we're focused on cannabinoids like CBG and things. I think in the future, if I was to look 5 years out, it's going to be more about taste, aroma, flavor, and bag appeal than it is now. So it's going to be about strawberry hemp, I think, in 5 years.
I completely agree with that. I actually recently got some products from a dispensary and they threw in some free joints. And when I got back and tried the joints out, they were so terrible that I told the dispensary, like, you guys, even though you're handing out free joints, you're doing yourself a disservice. You're actually making the experience worse because the free joints that you handed out were trash. They tasted so bad. I ended up having to, I basically just crumpled them up and threw them in the garden. But yeah, it was so nasty. So yeah, I completely agree. Taste, flavor, aroma, and then ultimately effects as well.
But even then, you can tell someone it's going to make them feel a certain way, but there's no substitute for it tastes really good. You know, we don't eat chocolate cake because we don't eat an apple because of its fiber content. We might choose an apple because it has fiber, but we still want a really tasty apple.
Right. And so, if the apple doesn't crunch, it's always terrible. It's such a weird thing. It could be the most tasty apple ever, but if it doesn't have that crunch pop, it's, make it into applesauce.
Yeah. So that's why I say flavor, bag appeal, aroma, taste. That's what I think the long-term is. Cannabinoids are important, but it's going to become less important, I think.
Totally.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, this is great. You got to go. So this was a blast. I had a really good fun time here. Seriously. Like I learned a lot and I could talk to you for hours.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey everyone, it's Ryan from the Cannabis Connoisseur podcast. If you're looking for ways to utilize cannabis to keep you healthy, strong, and sharp, come join us every Wednesday where we dive into the best ways to use cannabis to optimize your life. Topics include cannabis and athletics, cannabis for productivity, cannabis for anxiety, cannabis for a healthy immune system, and so much more. If you're a curious connoisseur, this show is for you. So please head over to our page, and we're looking forward to seeing you this week. Bye.